Hello, and welcome to the In the Moment magazine podcast. I'm Sarah Orme, the magazine's digital editor, and I'm joined by Kate Bennett, our production editor. Our guest today is Christine Bailey, the author of The Brain Boost Diet Plan, published by Nourish. Christine is an award-winning nutritional therapist, functional nutrition practitioner, chef, author, and broadcaster with over 12 years of experience. And today we're going to be talking to Christine about how what you eat can affect your mood, how stressed you are, and even your concentration. Okay, so where did the idea for the Brain Boost diet come from?
Well, that's an interesting one because my previous functional medicine book was on the gut health, and what we're now learning from research is that there's an actual, you know, research link between the brain functioning and how healthy your gut is. So in a way, it was a natural progression from the gut health book, but from a personal point of view, my gran actually suffered with Alzheimer's. So I went through a lot of my teenage life and early 20s, actually, watching her gradually deteriorate. And it was a horrible experience, you know, and feeling almost unable to help her. This was obviously a long time before I'd studied nutrition and so on as well. And also, you know, research into Alzheimer's and cognitive decline has advanced so much over the last 20, 30 years. So we know an awful lot more now than we ever did about the functioning of the brain and also the nutrients as well that it needs. But I suppose having experienced that, you know, and now in clinic, I see a lot of people probably in their 30s, 40s now thinking, is there anything I can do to enable me to enhance my cognitive function but also help prevent getting cognitive decline? Because I think it's one of those scary things that a lot of people think about.
Yeah, it's an interesting take on a diet as well, because diets are so normally focused on things like weight loss or staying in shape. The idea of changing your diet to focus on your brain is quite an interesting one.
It is, and yet, of course, we've all probably gone through a day where perhaps we haven't eaten well or we've skipped a meal and we suddenly realise, one, how irritable we feel, how moody or even lightheaded or foggy-headed we are. So we probably all are aware how different foods or even the lack of food can affect your functioning. So in a way, it goes to make sense that, and research is obviously confirming this, that certain foods have the capacity to actually enhance your brain performance, which is, from my perspective, really quite encouraging and motivating.
One thing I found really interesting looking at your book is the connection between what you eat and your mood. So the idea that your diet can actually have an effect on your mental health, is that something people can really benefit from?
Yeah, in particular, for anyone that suffers with not just depression, but just generally low mood or feeling a little bit up and down in their mood anyway, because it all goes back to the neurotransmitters that we produce. So our brain produces a whole range of chemicals that influence how we think and feel. And a couple of those are very associated with mood and motivation. So serotonin. And a lot of people would have probably heard of serotonin because often when you're given antidepressants, it's called an SSRI, which is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. The other neurotransmitter is dopamine. And a high dopamine type of person is one that's very motivated, you know, highly strong, maybe a perfectionist. Often we call them the city London workers, you know, the ones that are go, 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 go. That's a high dopamine type person. But of course, consequently, if you don't produce enough dopamine, then it can leave you feeling quite restless or unmotivated. You know, oh, I can't be bothered today. You might find that things don't excite you as much. And so those two neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin, have a profound effect on our mood and behaviour as well. And what we know is that, you know, to produce those neurotransmitters, we need certain proteins, we need certain amino acids, we need certain nutrients to help produce those neurotransmitters. And of course, if we are low in those nutrients or even deficient in those nutrients, then absolutely that's going to affect those productions. So changing what you eat, even if it's just tweaking it slightly, can actually influence the production of those mood-boosting neurotransmitters.
Okay, so, I've got one. I heard you talk a little bit about kind of cortisol and stuff recently at a wellness festival in Bath. And I was really interested in that because sometimes I do suffer with sleep. And my boyfriend actually works nights, so he's kind of the opposite way round, which is quite hard. And I was really interested in, if there's anything that you can kind of do food-wise that's going to help the cortisol production and how that then affects how you sleep and how you feel.
And actually, that's really interesting because there's a lot of research now about sleep, eating patterns, mood, and also brain health as well.
Yes.
Because actually, over the nighttime, our neurons are, just like a lot of the rest of our body, repairing, renewing. And, you know, the exciting thing for anyone listening is we have the ability to build new brain cells, whatever our age, as long as we treat it right.
Yeah.
The two things, as well as diet, that can really affect that is stress and poor sleep. And actually, night shift, wow, that has a profound effect on cortisol production, energy patterns, repair and renewal as well. So for some people, we call them the high cortisol producers. They are people that feel really quite highly strung a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean they're energetic, because you can be in a situation where you're tired but wired.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is probably what you're suffering with, because you get towards bedtime, but your mind is still racing.
Yes,
you know,
that's exactly
and you
what
can't,
happens, yeah.
You can't unwind. So there are a few things that we know can help calm that cortisol, because often you'll find that if you are in that situation, you've got too much cortisol. Now, too much cortisol at bedtime means you don't produce enough melatonin, mm-hmm. which is our sleep hormone, because cortisol blocks melatonin. So what we need to do is lower cortisol. So there's a few things that practically you can do. One of the first things is to sit in a bath of Epsom salts.
Yeah.
Which sounds a really strange thing to say, but Epsom salts is simply magnesium sulfate. Now, when we soak in a bath of magnesium, we actually absorb that magnesium through our skin. And magnesium is known as our mineral relaxer. So it calms the nervous system down. So it helps to calm us. Mm-hmm. And then there are herbals that we can use, valerian, chamomile, lemon balm, hops, all of these as teas, tinctures, can be really useful in, again, calming down cortisol and then raising another neurotransmitter called GABA.
Yes.
And GABA is associated with calming and focus, almost chill. It chills us. And so if anyone's listening who does yoga, meditation, when you do that, you produce more GABA. And that helps to produce more alpha waves, which calms the brain and the mind. And then there's practically other things. We are all renowned for taking our phones near the bed.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Laptops, computers, it could be a TV. Electrical signals in the bedroom is really not a good idea. You know, it overstimulates us. And particularly for children and teenagers, almost having an hour, which sounds a long time, but an hour before bed of no electrical stimulation can be really useful. there are other nutrients as well that can help. Again, calcium. And calcium and magnesium together are very calming. And that's why we think actually a milky drink before bedtime helps.
Yes, because obviously you hear that, don't you? Have a hot milk before bed. I don't remember me used to say that, but
yeah, and I think it's more to do with that. It does also contain tryptophan. And tryptophan is converted into our body to serotonin and then melatonin, so it can calm us. But I suspect it's more, it's a warming drink. It's got some calcium magnesium in as well.
Yes.
There is a drink called Montemasseri cherry active or concentrated cherry juice. And this type of cherry is one of the few sources of natural melatonin. Mm-hmm. So some people do find, and it has been studied in research, that having a warming drink of this Montemasseri cherry Just before bedtime can really help. Again, I think the whole thing about having a warming drink helps as well. It calms you down, it's relaxing, it's comforting. And then obviously basics like very dark room, not too hot, not too cold.
Yes, yeah.
And not having someone who walks in doing a night shift probably halfway through the night, I think, would help as well.
Yes. There is that. But yeah, that just little things I think that we can do to change it will help a better schedule and just to help switch off a bit more.
Yeah. I was just wondering about what foods you should be eating if you're feeling a bit stressed. Because I know personally, if I'm feeling stressed, I tend to reach for a bag of crisps or something sugary.
Biscuits.
Or, I'm drinking so much tea. What are the things we should be eating if we're feeling a bit stressed?
That's interesting as well, because there's two types of people when they're stressed. The ones that crave salty foods and the ones that crave sweet foods. And, of course, you can crave both.
Yeah, definitely. That's
definitely both, yeah.
Within the sweet foods, that also includes the caffeine. And there's a reason for all of those cravings, and that is because a lot of those will stimulate a sort of energy release. So we break down glycogen, we get more energy in our system, we feel a bit more perked up, and that sort of keeps us going. And caffeine will do that as well, which is why a lot of people reach for the coffee or the tea when they're stressed. So what we need to do is counteract that. So craving carbs, the opposite would be you start your day with a protein-rich breakfast. So something like eggs and vegetables, for example, scrambled egg with spinach or smoked salmon, maybe some slow-releasing carbohydrate like oat cakes or something like that. That would be a good option, because what it's doing is it's helping to stabilise your blood sugar. When you're stressed and you're producing lots of cortisol, you're going to get seesaws in blood sugar. So we need to counteract that. And for people that are stressed, actually, snacking occasionally is a good thing, because it's going to keep your blood sugar stable. So mid-morning or mid-afternoon, particularly when we want to reach for that chocolate cake, have a handful of nuts and seeds to hand. Some people will have a little tub of Greek yogurt because it's quite creamy, maybe some hummus, maybe some oat cakes, maybe some nut butters, those sort of things that will not upset your blood sugar. Keep those hunger pangs at bay as well, which is really important, so you're not then tempted. And also, if you're someone that has to work late, you might need a sort of 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock snack, because it might be, 8 or 9 before you can have a proper dinner. And that's when you start getting really irritable and then your stress levels get up as well. So focus more on protein. Focus on slow-releasing carbohydrates, so brown rice, oat cakes, porridge oats, those sort of things, and include some healthy fats. Now, we are often in a situation where people are still a bit fat-phobic, but that's really not a good idea for your brain. And the reason is your brain is 60% fat.
Wow.
And it needs that fat. The cell membranes, the neurons, your brain cells, your myelin sheaths, which sort of covers the nervous system and protects it, they're all made of fat. And they're made of particularly the omega-3 fats and also something called phospholipids. So I mentioned eggs for breakfast. Well, eggs are one of the best sources of phospholipids. And they help to really protect those myelin sheaths. So they help your brain to work quicker and work more effectively. So again, don't be fat phobic when it comes to brain health.
I find as well with fats, because I do quite a lot of exercise and weightlifting, and it was introducing a lot more fats into my diet that actually really helped me not to get hunger cravings. So it took me longer to actually, I guess, process them and kind of go through. And that, yeah, I really enjoyed that, because then I wasn't craving the quick hit carb fix with the biscuits.
And that's a good point, because both fat and protein are what we call more satiating. They fill you up. They do take longer for the digestive tract to actually process. So they sit longer and they keep your blood sugar stable. So again, when you're looking at meal planning, always look at your plate and say, one, where is my protein? Two, where is my healthy fat? So I'm talking things like oily fish, avocados, nuts and seeds, olives, olive oil. I mean, the Mediterranean diet has to be one of the best diets for health, but also for the brain.
Mm.
And so a lot of the recipes in my brain diet book are very sort of Mediterranean focused, lots of colour, lots of antioxidant-rich vegetables. So always look at your plate, say, where is my protein, where is my fat, and then put loads of colour vegetables on there. That makes a really good brain-boosting diet.
Wow.
Another thing I spotted in the your book, which I found was really interesting, is that you recommend cutting out gluten. And I found that really interesting, what you were saying about gluten being addictive. Is it really something that people are hooked on?
Well, there's a lot of problems with gluten, and I don't want to sound like a gluten fanatic, but we do know from the sort of, you know, the relative research that's been out there, that there is a big difference now between just being considered celiac, but also now gluten sensitive. And what we now know is what we call non-celiac gluten sensitive. So you don't have to be celiac to have a problem with gluten. What we now know is that gluten can cause a lot of damage to the gut lining, the blood-brain barrier, and it can also instigate what we call autoimmunity. So as well as obviously causing damage to the gut, which is what often happens in celiac disease, it can cause systemic inflammation in the body, including the brain. And there are a lot of cases now where gluten consumption has been linked to depression. It's been linked to neurological diseases, even epilepsy. And so it's very much a systemic problem for the body, eating gluten. And there are people that will almost get an opioid-like effect when they eat gluten. So when we break gluten down, which is a whole collection of different peptides, different proteins, some of those can almost attach onto opioid receptors in the brain and cause us to feel quite good when we eat gluten. And of course, the trouble is, when you stop eating gluten, you get almost a little slump, a bit like if you were taking morphine or codeine, for example. So yes, for some people, it can have an addictive effect. But that's only one of the effects of gluten. And that's why all the recipes are gluten-free, because we know from the research now that the effects of the systemic inflammation can have quite a profound effect on the brain cells. And in fact, when you look at the research, one of the things that comes through in a lot of cognitive decline conditions, even Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, is inflammation, inflammation on the brain. So we need to be looking at, well, what foods increase inflammation and what foods decrease inflammation? And by changing that shift in your diet, that can also have a very protective effect on your brain.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't know. I think when I was reading it through, I thought that would be the hardest part for me, giving
and
up the bread.
And it is for a lot of people. I mean, I do obviously a lot of functional lab testing on people to actually find out, okay, is gluten having an effect on you? And that actually can be very motivating, because although deep down you might think, do I have a problem with gluten? If you see a lab test that clearly highlights you have a problem, then you're much more motivated to take it out. And that's one of the advantages of doing proper lab testing.
I definitely have experienced that, because I don't know if it's with gluten or something that's often put with gluten, but I have a real problem. I get really bad stomach pains and lots of things, and I feel really sluggish. And actually, when my doctor finally told me, it wasn't until a couple of years ago, I realised that that was the reason why I didn't actually enjoy lots of things like toast and bread and biscuits and lots of things, you know, like sort of crackers, because obviously there was something from my childhood that has sort of reminded me that I'm in pain when I eat this, but I didn't realise, and it took me so long to realise. And it was hard. The sweeter things were harder for me, like biscuits, like chocolate biscuits, because they raked. But actually, when I come down to it and I have to make a choice now, because I know that it causes me a problem and I can remind myself of how I will feel, it's a little bit easier to actually give it up. And as well, I find it easier just cutting out, you know, even the replacements and things. It just doesn't really help me to have those.
And they're not that healthy.
No.
You know? I mean, that's one of the problems. And that's why I have included in the book a lot of alternatives, you know, how to make your own paleo breads without gluten,
yes.
Muffins, you know, sweet treats that don't have the sugar. Because
yes.
when you look at a lot of the free from food, generally speaking, they're replacing some of that flavour and that texture feel with fats that may not necessarily be healthy, with salt, with flavourings, and of course sugar.
Yes.
And sugar is actually very toxic to the brain. And again, I know people may not want to hear that, but it's very inflammatory. And what's interesting is if you look at the connection between diabetes type 2 and Alzheimer's, it's very strong. In fact, Alzheimer's is now termed type 3 diabetes.
Oh, wow.
Because there is this inflammatory response in the brain. And so people who have problems with blood sugar control, and you don't have to be a diabetic, of course, to have a problem with blood sugar, are unfortunately more at risk from certain brain conditions.
Yes, I think, yeah, it's quite an interesting one actually, seeing that coming through, especially because even 20 years ago, it just wasn't such a big thing at all. People didn't have gluten-free on the menu or anything, so it's nice to actually see a change, and especially when it's a change in how the entire dish is prepared and made up of different things rather than just, oh, we're swapping that in for gluten-free pasta.
And you do have to be careful because actually when you start delving in into foods, where gluten is found, it's found in so many foods. And it's not just a simple procedure to go out to a restaurant anymore. You know, the gravy, the soups, the sauces, you know, whether it's been pan-fried in a bit of flour or something like that.
Yeah.
You have to watch everything.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to be very careful eating out.
Yeah, my cousin is celiac and I know he really struggles with that. Mm. It's in everything. It's,
yeah.
It's in chocolate, it's in oven chips, it's just kind of snuck into
in.
Food. That you wouldn't really expect to find it in. And so it's really hard for him.
And our family's gluten-free as well. And I remember when I took my eldest son out for a meal out, and he's effectively celiac.
Mm.
And I remember going to this one particular restaurant, and he was so relieved because when we spoke, I mean, they knew I was a chef, so he actually took Nathan into the kitchens and showed him, this is where we prepare the gluten-free stuff, this is where we prepare the gluten stuff, there is no risk of cross-contamination, we use separate fryers to fry things. And he was so calm and relaxed because it can be quite a tense experience eating out if you've got allergies.
Mm.
I mean, I'm actually involved in the Free From Awards, so I'm one of the judges, and we go out to all these restaurants and we have to ask them all these questions. And actually, there have been a few occasions this year where we've been judging restaurants and they've known we've had allergies and they've still slipped up.
Wow.
And that's scary.
Yes.
Because
yes.
Obviously, if you're celiac, you won't necessarily get an anaphylactic reaction, but it's still serious because any small amount of gluten will damage that gut. Whether you feel it or not, you're going to get that inflammation. So, you know, for people that are celiac, you have to be 100% gluten-free. You can't just be a little bit gluten because that will be damaging you. And it's the same, you know, what we emphasise with the Brain Boost diet is, you know, make that switch because there are lots of healthy, natural alternatives. And in a way, I encourage people to go back to real food, natural food. So avoid the processed aisle and, you know, choose sweet potato, choose whole grain rice, choose quinoa. Pile up with loads of veg. These are all naturally gluten-free. Meats, fish, eggs, all naturally gluten-free. So almost going back to basics, one, it's healthier and it's cheaper as well. But then you're guaranteed it's gluten-free.
Yes. Okay. So bringing it back to the book, I was wondering if you could just give us a bit of an overview of how the diet works, because I noticed you've broken it down into weeks, and it's sort of a phased introduction rather than overwhelming yourself all at once.
Yeah, and it's also really, it's going back to the research, and I use what we call a functional medicine approach, which is, let's look at the underlying reasons why you feel your brain is not working well. You know, we all often say, why is my brain not working as well as it should? Well, there will be underlying reasons for that. And so the book looks, in the introduction, it looks at all of those things that could be relevant to you. And so we break the program down into four stages. And the first one is we need to cleanse the brain and the body. And that really means removing the triggers. So for some people, it's you're eating too much sugar, you're eating gluten, You may be in a toxic environment that we need to just declutter and detox. You may not be managing your stress well. These are all things that can be affecting your brain. So the first sort of week is really saying, okay, how can we cleanse the body? How can we take these foods out if we need to? How can we put foods in that will actually support liver function, kidney function, gut health? So it talks people through those areas and those key foods as well. Then we say, okay, well, we need to start renewing the brain. You know, what is it that the brain needs that perhaps we're not getting so much of? Are we getting the right amino acids, which are the building blocks of all those neurotransmitters that affect how we think and feel? Are we getting all the cofactor nutrients, the B vitamins, the zinc, the magnesium, the iron, that we need to process those as well? Do we need to support our gut health? Because often, because there is such a connection between the gut and the brain, if there is dysfunction in the gut, that will affect your mood and behaviour as well. So do we need to put in fermented foods or gut healing foods? And then we look at revitalising the brain as well and protecting the brain. So we have these 4 weeks. And the last section also embraces lifestyle. Because excitingly, and we've already talked about stress and sleep, exercise is one of the most powerful ways to enhance your brain's capacity. Not just in how we feel, because obviously, you know, when you exercise, you often get endorphins, it boosts serotonin, we feel good. But actually, did you know that when you exercise, and this includes aerobic exercise and also weight training, is that you increase something called brain neurotrophic derived factor. Now, this is like growth hormone for your brain. It's like a fertilizer for your brain. It helps you build new brain cells. Mm. I mean, how exciting is that? You know, jog your way to a better memory, really. And you don't have to do a lot because it's, oh, well, I don't do marathons. You don't have to. 30 minutes a day has been shown to improve this brain neurotrophic derived factor and increase your capacity for your neurons to communicate to each other, for circulation and oxygenation in the brain, which, again, is very beneficial for improving how well you use glucose. So it improves insulin function. And, of course, endorphins. So there's other ways as well as the diet that we talk about that you really, for a healthy brain long term, that you really need to address. And, I mean, I'm a big fan of exercise anyway. I love exercise. But just how profound the research is showing it can have on your brain function, whatever age you are. And that's exciting as well. It's never, ever too late to make changes that will change the way you think and feel.
And that's exciting, especially if it can then prevent the onset of certain brain illnesses. I think that's something that a lot of people are going to be excited about.
Mm. Yes,
and it's never too early to start, because a lot of people, you know, when you're in your 20s and 30s, you think you're indestructible. And I certainly felt that, you know, you can get away with it.
Mm.
But actually, what's really interesting about things like Alzheimer's is that we know the damage is starting in your 40s, well, even in some cases earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, taking action in your 30s and 40s is actually the best time. And we talk about some of the risk factors involved with Alzheimer's and cognitive decline and what you can do about them. There's certain blood tests that you could perhaps think about doing, asking your GP for. I mean, I don't want people to get paranoid, but, you know, if you can take action early, then again, that's enhancing not only your overall health, but also your brain health long term.
Another thing that I picked up when I was reading the book is that you mentioned a lot about fermented foods, which is, I know, a really big trend at the moment. And I was actually quite excited to think about how you can make these yourselves.
Mm.
Does it take a lot of effort and preparation?
Not at all. And this is one of the things I wanted to sort of dispel in the brain book. And we talk about it in the gut book as well, obviously. I mean, I'm a big fan of fermented foods. And when I mean fermented foods, I mean things like very much traditional foods. So kimchi, which is very much a Korean, quite spicy food. Sauerkraut, kefir, yogurt, miso, tempeh, natto. These are all traditional fermented foods that pretty much every culture would be using in some form. Mm-hmm. And when you go back to, you know, traditional diets and cultures, you will find every one of them would ferment foods. Now, they weren't doing it because, oh, this is good for my gut, this is good for my brain. They were doing it to preserve food, really, you know, to make the most of food in the seasons and then keep it going through the rest of the year. But now what we know is that these fermented foods are packed with beneficial bacteria. These beneficial bacteria then enhance your own gut flora, and these gut flora produce hormones, neurotransmitters, chemicals that influence our brain and also lower inflammation, support your healthy gut, help us digest and process foods, create B vitamins, vitamin K and so on. And yet they're very easy to make. Mm. Now, I was actually brought up, my gran, she was a vicar's wife, and so she would ferment and make chutneys and everything. So I was very much brought up in that ilk. But a lot of people, this is quite scary stuff. But actually, it's really simple. I mean, you are simply, you know, to make sauerkraut, you are simply just chopping up or even grating cabbage, maybe some carrot. You then macerate it in a bit of brine solution. You can add a probiotic if you want. And you stick it in a jar and you leave it to ferment for a couple of weeks. I mean, it really is that simple. Making your own yogurt is very, very easy. Mm. And so in the book, I give you recipes for all of those. And if you are dairy-free, we show you how to make coconut yogurt or nut yogurt. So there's something to suit everyone. And I mean, I actually run days on fermented foods. So I show people how to make them. And at the end of it, they're saying, I wish I'd done this earlier because it's so easy. Yes, you might need to get a few Kilner jars, which are really cheap to get these days. That's about it, really. And the great thing is you save yourself an awful lot of money. It's a lot cheaper. And you can vary it, you know. So I often will make a sauerkraut, and there's one in the book which has got some anti-inflammatories in as well. So I add some turmeric in there. I add some pineapple in there. You know, you can just jazz it up for your own tastes. And again, you will often find that, you know, you might think, oh, children won't like these. Actually, children really like these because they've got a bit of kick to them. They've got a bit of spice to them. And if you stir in a little bit of mayonnaise, you've almost got a fermented coleslaw. And you don't need to tell them that it's healthy. Yeah, they'll love it anyway.
Yeah, put it on their plate. I think that's so important because I think, especially with a lot of the wellness movement that is happening now on Instagram and social media, a lot of people do find it unachievable. They think, oh, kimchi, I've not even heard of that, let alone where would I buy it. I'm just going to ignore it. I can't use it. But actually, it's quite easy to make your own variations.
It's very easy.
It's nice to be able to have that and actually see how you can do it and incorporate it in your life, I think.
Yeah. And also, again, this is cheap. I mean, again, you've mentioned Instagram, and I think, you know, from a sort of stress point of view, people can get very worked up looking at all these unachievable bodies and images and foods and, oh, mine never looks that good. It doesn't have to. And, you know, I think, again, in the book, I keep the food to everyday ingredients, keeping it simple, keeping it quite family orientated as well. It doesn't mean you have to have a family, but things that everyone would eat. I mean, I've got a fish pie in there, for goodness sake, but I've just jazzed it up to make it healthier. We use sweet potato in there. We use prawns. We use salmon, you know. So there's lots of ways of taking almost quite traditional favourites, everyday foods, but making it so much healthier for the brain. And just tweaking it so that it's got more of the healthy fats and the protein in and less of the carbs. So, you know, there are ways that you can sneak in ingredients or just make simple tweaks to make it healthy. And, you know, I've got three boys. I haven't got time to spend ages photographing all my food and, you know, spending ages in the kitchen. So, again, it's got to be quick, simple, practical. Mm. Can I make it in bulk? Can I freeze it? And, again, in a way, for the brain point of view, the more you can take the stress off, preparing food, again, the better for you.
Yes, yeah. I was going to ask, actually, have you got a favourite recipe in the book?
Oh, gosh. Oh, my goodness. Well, I think my boys still like the sweet treats.
Mm.
And, you know, we've got some lovely cakes and bars in there as well. I'm a big fish fan. I'm also a big veggie fan as well. So we've got quite a lot of this in this book. Actually, what I've done is I've included perhaps more vegan and vegetarian recipes than perhaps some of the other books would have in. So one of the ones that my boys like is it's almost like a sort of vegan cauliflower cheese type recipe.
Ooh, that sounds great.
It's really creamy, really easy to make, and incredibly healthy. And it's very comfort food, you know, but healthy because I've kept the carbs down. So things like that, I think I really like. I mean, my boys, again, they like the traditional favourites as well. We've got some meatballs in there. We've got fish pies in there, you know, so they like those sort of foods. There's a really interesting, which sounds a little bit strange, but it's a layered sort of cheesecake pudding, which we've used lemon in, which is, again, the citrus foods are very high in limonene. They're very protective for the brain. But also we've included avocado, which might sound strange, but bear with me. It really works and it's rich and creamy. And again, you know, that's something that, you know, my family absolutely adore. You're getting all those healthy fats in, you're getting a sweet treat. Those sort of things could actually be used as breakfast options because they're so energising. So there's a lot that you can tweak for, oh, well, I can make that as a dessert. Oh, but I can have that for breakfast. It's so healthy. Why not?
I think that's nice when, yeah, something that you consider to be a bit of a comfort treat can be something you can actually, is nutritious enough to have as part of your regular meals. I think that's lovely.
here's a good news is that actually, you know, if you get really good dark chocolate and raw cacao, which is very high in antioxidants, actually is a really good brain food. So there are some chocolate recipes in there, you'll be pleased to know as well.
Excellent.
It's a
good.
Great mood booster.
We'll have to get some in the office.
Oh, definitely. I mean, any excuse.
Yeah. So.
Okay, I think we probably better wrap up. Before we finish, though, so if there's anybody who's looking at this and perhaps thinking, oh, it's a bit intimidating to transform my whole diet, what's the most easy thing that they can change about their diet that will help their brain?
Well, first of all, I'd say it's not intimidating because I have given you a 4-week plan, literally step by step, day by day. This is what you could eat. This is what you can do. So I really have broken it down. But the first thing I would say is, first of all, take a look at your overall diet and just take a look at how much carbohydrate you're eating. Because actually, if there's one thing you could do, and that is probably to decrease the carbohydrate, particularly the sugars. And we're talking here things like fruit juices, dried fruit even, you know, which is very sugary. And upping the lean protein, the chickens, the venison, the duck, the beans and pulses, the fish, the prawns, the shellfish, all of those, increase those. Do not be fat phobic. So, you know, nut butters, avocado, olives, you know, all of these great foods. And don't be afraid to experiment with going back to basics and keeping your food simple. You don't have to have these elaborate meals. Just keep it simple. Keep it to those key foods and those will really nourish your brain.
So where can you buy the Brain Boost diet plan?
Well, it's readily available from the, you know, bookshops, but also Amazon.
Okay, and when does it go on sale?
Goes on sale officially on January the 18th, but you can pre-order it now.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us today, Christine.
Yeah, I think
we've both really enjoyed talking to you.
You're welcome.
Okay, and to everybody listening, I hope you enjoyed the podcast and we'll be back again very soon.
You can find some recipes from Christine's book on our website, calmmoment.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd be really grateful if you could rate it and leave a review. We'd also love to hear any comments or feedback you'd like to give us about this podcast. And you can contact us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter at In The Moment Mag. Or you can email us at calmmoment@immediate.co.uk.